You have a quasi-agenda that you would like to?
Oh, yeah.
This is part of a new series that you're going to do?
It's basically me just sort of tightening up on my mission, which is to get best practitioners to tell me exactly what they do and how they do it. Best practitioners, that's what I want, is a kaleidoscopic examination of the book. That's been the mission all along.
A kaleidoscopic examination? You sound like a proctologist. A proctologist of the book.
That's good. That's good. I think I'll use that. If I write a book, I'm going to get you to blurb it like that. Anyway, yeah, that's it. And you're one of the things that I find up there.
Yeah, good colon scopes.
Yeah, you're a polyp.
Many people have said. I follow what you're getting at. Let me leave it to you then, just to open the dialogue, and I will pursue it with you.
Very good. Is there something on your website you would like me to?
You know, it's funny you say that. We literally just finished an incredibly elaborate 6-month production. I'm not sure why, except my staff persuaded me it made sense to do it, because we never really have a website. If you go on, it's as dull as a 3-day-old tuna fish sandwich. But they've just undertaken, you know, at not inconsiderable cost, building a very elaborate website with bells and whistles. It was going to go live about a week ago, but there's a small, I guess it is a crisis to a number of people. There's a law firm down in the United States. I don't know if it's happened up in Canada, but in the United States, there's a, you know, tried, tested and enduring law concerning disabled people's rights concerning entrance to buildings and this or that. So a lawyer who clearly makes his living looking for loopholes in laws found a blind woman to act as his plaintiff, and has sued a number of booksellers, and I guess gallerists too, but booksellers in particular, who have websites that don't conform to the ADA standards.
They want you to put Braille on the screen? Is that
well? What it's not Braille. I mean, it's bells and whistles. Lauren, my associate, who you know would be is sort of involved in talking to a number of these people. I've not followed it, because she's overseeing the build out of the website. But apparently, it's very straightforward. I mean, all of these websites do not conform to the rather simple A through Z regulations that are built into the ADA law. You know, and so people have been disgorging, you know, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000. You know, as penalties, and then going back and having to spend even more money to rebuild their websites. So probably fortunately for us, that's probably be a good blog, but a good podcast. But fortunately for us, one of our closest associates here in the city, an autograph dealer that I actually went to college with, got entrapped in this oversized fishing net to the tune of about $25,000, and was able to alert us. Not really nervous, because he knows that we don't need to be said, well, you're lucky you don't have a website. Lauren said, well, we are about to have one a week later. So we have gone back for a week or 10 days to the drawing board. So there will be a very elaborate website.
I just need a very little blurb on you that you're happy with. Is it up there right now on your existing site or not?
It must be. But if I told you I've never looked at it, I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, let's just go with Revered. Do you like Revered?
I think you would get a lot of blowback, I have to tell you, really.
On Revered? Sure, yeah. Okay.
Maybe my two daughters might potentially enjoy it.
Sure, but, okay. Okay, so Glenn Horowitz is a seasoned and highly regarded, some might say notorious, archive dealer and bookseller. Are we good with that?
That's correct.
You want to put anything else in there?
No, I think the notorious probably summed it up beautifully. Yep. Ruth Ginsburg and I.
Very good. Welcome, Glenn, again to the Bibliophile.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you again, Nigel.
Okay, so let me just get a handle on what you do. It seems to me that what you do is you look for things of value, and then you approach the people who own that valuable thing and you propose that you can sell it for them in a way that results in getting the true value and placing whatever that thing of value is in an institution, typically, that it deserves to end up in. Is that, would you say that's good?
It's fundamentally correct. It's rough at the edges.
Like myself.
Yeah, that's it. Our business is bifurcated between transactions with large research institutions and or foundation entities that for various reasons have an interest in participating in the type of archival material DNA that we handle, with the other percentage of our transactions being done directly with collectors and end users of the sort of books and manuscripts that I find interesting and that they have also grown to feel is compelling.
Okay.
I mean, and just to refine it for you, I would say yes. That in terms of the number of transactions, or as my grandfather, the ancient furniture salesman on the Catskill Mountains, used to say, the number of tickets that we write, the higher percentage goes into the column of private collectors, the larger dollar volume, of course, given the size of the archival transactions, falls into the column of institutions.
Very good. Okay. So I want to talk about Sting. Sting just sold his backlist, or I guess it's the rights to his backlist of songs, for $300 million. Now, he would have sold that to some kind of organization that will make money off that backlist.
The transaction that reached the press recently about Sting's sale is part of a short list of transactions that, you know, genuinely global musical figures ranging from Dylan to Paul Simon to Neil Young and Sting, Joni Mitchell, have engaged in with the major labels. Fundamentally, what they're really doing is they're just tying up the loose ends at the end of their lives, professional lives, and you're cashing it in. And I'm sure that a lot of it is driven by estate considerations, which is, it's much easier to divide a pile of residual cash amongst generations of survivors than have somebody managing all of these, you know, endless streams of revenue that come from various platforms. Again, I haven't followed the Sting one, but in the case of Dylan, who, as you know, participated twice, dipped twice, I mean, there's a difference between the publication rights and the performance rights. And in the case of Dylan, he did, because he's Bob, controlled both of them. So I haven't followed the Sting story, but yes, I mean, they bundled the rights to his songs and sold it to somebody who bought it to exploit it. There's nothing philanthropic about any of these transactions. They're done by large multinational corporations for the benefit of their stakeholders.
So just the idea of looking for value. So there's Sting. Now, Sting he's probably got a ton of notebooks that he's written song lyrics in. He's got a bunch of material that and he's written some books, could feasibly end up in an institution, correct?
Yes, there's no question. I mean, how it gets there is another strain of the dialogue. But yes, I mean, there's no question, you know, as happened when we did deals for both in recent memory, Bob Dylan and David Byrne, all of their leavings were ultimately acquired by research-driven institutions. You know, as long as music remains, it seems to be contemporary music in particular, you know, a staple of the language that we collectively speak, and the glamour of rock and roll and popular music continues, I mean, there will be institutions that find this a compelling and you know, savvy way to increase their brand of scholarship.
Plus attendance, right?
You know, it really that's a good question. But I mean, it is true. And this is about when I entered, well, I shouldn't say entered, when I expanded our you know, vision, a portfolio of what archival material we would work on. I was hired. The only other significant tranche of Bob Dylan material that sits in an institution, other than the massive collection that we sent out to Tulsa, Oklahoma, through the auspices of the Geiser Foundation, is either amusingly, touchingly, poignantly, is owned by the Morgan Library of all places, and their much smaller collection was acquired by gift from a fellow, with a capital F, of the Morgan Library, who had collected it over many years, collected it when it was easier to find it and less expensive. When the Morgan received the material and announced it, there was a tremendous kerfuffle on the part of Dylan and Dylan's people over why in God's name this material was not only not in Bob's hands, but now in the hands of the Morgan Library, and the Morgan Library was prepared to make it available to the public. It turned out that the material, the transfer of title from Bob to his close early companions on the road in the early 60s was incontestable.
And these people just sold it, right?
They sold it when it rose sufficiently in value to attract the attention of collectors. The Morgan, having no dog in the fight and certainly not having any reason to want to create bad blood between themselves and Bob Dylan, reached an agreement with Bob that they wouldn't exhibit the material or make it available after his death. At some point, I may be blurring the edges of this, but at some point, apparently, Bob went in the city out of curiosity, because he is something of a self-archivist, asked the Morgan if he could come over and review the material. This was after the deal had been memorialized over how it would be handled. And they said, you know, we'll be thrilled. Come, we'll give you lunch. And Bob went over and looked at it. And I think he was sufficiently moved to see that early work and realized that there was nothing explosive about it. And so he said to them, look, if you really want to, I'll lift the restrictions. He said, what we'd really love to do, if you're prepared to do that, is an exhibition of the material. What happened was they did an exhibition, and it turned out, to their astonishment, remembering something about the history of the Morgan Library and the nature of the people who've served as trustees and benefactors over the years, it turned out to be the single most heavily attended exhibition in the history of the Morgan Library.
So when was that?
I would guess probably somewhere around 2005, 2006, but you know, it's easy enough to dig it up. And nonetheless, at the end of it, it traveled to one or two other venues. And when the material came back, those venues reported to the Morgan, they had very similar experiences with just, you know, a flood of people coming through the doors. Yeah, and I think they may have sensed at the time that the days of people walking through the doors to look at, you know, the miniature notebooks of the Bronte sisters versus looking at Bob Dylan's handwritten manuscripts of Blowing in the Wind, it had been a somersault in terms of interest. So they then hired us at the Morgan at the request of the trustees, because they said, look, this stuff is clearly more valuable than we initially thought it was, and what we are carrying it on our, you know, P&L for, in a sense, right?
Did the person donate it to the Morgan, or did he get paid?
No, he did. The gentleman in question had been a good friend to the Morgan. He and I, Ms. Extra, built a great George Bernard Shaw collection back in the 80s, which mm-hmm. he then gave in block to the Morgan. So this was the second major gift he had made. I don't know if his tax credits were taken at the time of the gift at the level that they were then appraised at, but when we got done appraising it, it really did cause a lot of genuine consternation on the part of the Morgan that somehow, you know, this extraordinarily valuable pot of material was there. You know, in many ways, that to me was an eye-opening experience. The combination of being able to justify, in a proper revenue service sound appraisal, the material at the level that we did, plus listening to, you know, my colleagues at the Morgan just sort of babble and drool on themselves over the remarkable response they got to it, you know, just suggested to me that there was probably a world out there that was worth pursuing.
Okay, so let's go back to Sting.
You seem obsessed by this thing.
Well, I do, just because I think it's an interesting case. And plus it helps me with my questioning of you. So, for example, you would let's say, oh, you know what? We should approach Sting and see what he's got. Mm-hmm. So how would you do that? And what would you ask him? And what would you look for?
How I approach it is you know, each case is, you know, is different. It's not that difficult for me, having done this for as many years as I have, to, you know, shrink, you know, 6 degrees of separation down to 1 degree of separation. And yeah. I've been very fortunate and blessed in the course of doing what ultimately became that massive transaction for Mr. Dylan. I grew very, very close to his remarkably intelligent and humane business manager of 40 years, Jeff Rosen. who really does seem to sit, you know, at least intellectually at the center of this world of popular music. And each time people question, having read about the Dylan transaction, if the clients they represent you know, might be suitable candidates for a transaction, they go to Jeff, who then fortunately says, you know, you should go chat with my friend Len.
So if you ask me, I
would just ask somebody relatively high in the music business to introduce me.
You've got a great reputation for doing well by people who own stuff. You know, you're the go-to guy. So it's not difficult for you then.
I think what we have a reputation for that serves our commercial purposes is for being frank with people. And from there, projects either will take off or be backburnered or in some cases, you know, abandoned. But you know, I've noticed over the years that one of the modest compliments that's paid to me by the people that I speak to who come to me for advice is, thank you for being as straightforward and frank with me about it and not blowing smoke up my backside. In the case of people like Paul Simon or Neil Young, Dylan, you know, it would be foolish to be anything other than frank because, you know, they don't need me. they only want me if there's something I can do for them at that point in time, right? They all have enough friends.
Well, you know, that's the thing, you know. I see what you've done for various collections in the form, at least, of your catalogs, and I'm blown away by how magnificent they are.
You're talking now about the printed catalogs that you and I have discussed that over the years, our mutual friend Jerry Kelly, who's been on your podcast, I have to acknowledge that I think that at this juncture in my commercial trajectory, that the days of producing those very elaborate catalogs probably are running out. And it's not because there isn't material to do it. We produced one about a year, year and a half ago, 2 years ago maybe now, for Franklin Roosevelt that I thought was as good as anything we've done, both aesthetically and textually. But there's such an abundance of information that crosses the screen daily.
It seems to me that you do such a beautiful job of presenting both, well, presenting the value of what you have and then also writing about it. It's as much to show the client or your client, you know, this is what I can do for you as much as using it as a sales
offer. I mean, if it was a coin, there would be both two sides to it. And you're right. I mean, we've used the catalogs for two reasons. I've written a couple of catalogs in the past, literally with one client in mind. You know, I had a Churchill collection many years ago that I was eager to sell to my already established client, Steve Forbes, Malcolm Forbes Jr., who at the time was building what was by far the most interesting Churchill collection in private hands. But knowing Steve and his predilections and his attention span, it struck me that rather than trying to peddle these books across the boardroom table at Forbes magazine, creating a catalog, and it was a beautiful collection that you could really narrate Churchill's life through these books and objects, and then presenting him with the galleys before the catalog went out, would serve my purpose. And indeed it worked, and he bought the entire collection except for three or four items. But we used the catalogs posthumously, both as a way of introducing ourselves to people that we might want to represent or do business with on the buy side, and also as a way of lubricating the imagination, as you were saying a moment ago, of new potential clients who look and say, you know, what is it you can do for me? And we say, this is what we handle. This is how we present it. This is what I believe we can do for you. But I'm just not sure that like certain other types of printed material that were once common in the world of rare books and manuscripts, that the lifespan or the shelf life of that type of catalog has not begun to run its course. And even some of the older and much more and distinguished firms that have been around for generations, Mags Brothers in London, Quaritch, they all seem to have now, of course, not reverted, but have migrated their catalog texts online, and you simply don't see printed catalogs showing up.
That makes them that much more collectible, Glenn, because well, they're to be making them anymore.
No. Look, I mean, there's right? no question that thank you, Will Rogers. Yes. No, they don't make it anymore. That's right. It's land and catalog. They're both finite.
Right. Okay. So let's look at how you write your catalogs. You, first of all, you're putting them in a beautiful format. And that's what I talked to Jerry about. But you're using some very persuasive techniques. I want you to tell me about those.
Well, I mean, we write the catalogs. If it's a catalog that's dedicated to a particular collection, and the collection has more than an amorphous shape to it, or more interestingly, it's a collection that's dedicated to the work of one individual writer or public figure.
Like
the Grushkin catalog. And that's a slightly unusual one because Grushkin was not a text-based figure. He was the designer. Right. So the ability to take existing text and then lace it through fresh text, the text we create, is slightly different. But what we do is whenever I'm training young associates who come aboard and join the firm, is in teaching them how to describe a book or an object. I use the slightly juvenile or adolescent expression of, you know, I want it to be from the inside out. So if you actually look at a book catalog that we've written, we use a format of cataloging, very much derived from a traditional British library format, a little spin on it, where we basically zero in on the title page and then move further out and out and out. So we go from the declared information on the title page and copyright page about what this title is, into the question of its physical aspects in the second paragraph, so that anybody who is sensitive to books would understand the condition of that particular object. From there, we move into any bibliographical information that is of value. And from there, we then move into both a biographical and a historical moment in which we try to create a context in which to understand the merit and therefore value of that particular object. So it really, you know, sort of is looking in and then zooming back out that we try to do. And by the end, it gives you an opportunity to spiel endlessly, but you've established conclusively before that what that object is and why that object merits the amount of attention that we're dedicating to it.
Okay, so very specifically about the merit. Merit is different than, for example, scarcity. Like scarcity is obviously a determinant of value. If it's unique, that's obviously important, I guess, because you can't get it anywhere else. But as far as merit goes, you, for example, writing, you know, this book caused this change in the world?
Well, I mean, you know, if you have a copy of a book, if you have a copy of a text, I hesitate to use the word book because but we have a copy of a text in whatever format it exists. Right? The double helix was first introduced into the world in the form of a very flimsy off-print from a scientific magazine, and that off-print today trades for, you know, tens and tens of thousands of dollars. But if you have a text in its original incarnation that has about it world-altering elements, you know, as a vendor of valuable book objects, that's a pretty good hand of cards to be sitting at the table with. If that particular text then in turn is embodied in a copy of the format that the book, that the text was introduced into, that makes it unique, you know, then you've got yourself a very potent piece of property. And even the word unique is in some ways deserves a qualification, because you could argue that, you know, every copy of, say, Ernest Hemingway's first book, privately printed in Paris in 1923, Three Stories and Ten Poems, that Hemingway inscribed is unique. Is there, however, you know, a way of grading the difference between the copy that he inscribed to the stock boy at Sylvia Beach's Shakespeare and Company, because he was always very generous to Hemingway when Hemingway came in to exchange books at the Lending Library, versus the copy that he inscribed to Maxwell Perkins on the day that Perkins buys his first book from him in 1925. Yeah. And the difference between those is the space that you can drive one of those Canadian tractor trailers on the bridge right now through.
Those things don't move, though.
No, I guess they've taken all the diesel out, so they can't move them.
That's right.
It seems to be both a more subtle and then ultimately even brutal phenomena, because you move from an aesthetic decision into one that's, you know, is based on, you know, hardcore currency. How far can you push something? You see, yeah, for example, yeah, I'm sure talking to many booksellers and visiting book fairs here and there, that within the trade, there is a great deal of, how would you say, you know, horse swapping that goes on, people buying books from other dealers, what have you. Clearly, at that moment, one of two reasons, or three reasons, I suppose, exist for why a bookseller would buy another, would buy an expensive book from another dealer. Right? They look at that book and they say, gee, you know, Nigel just has missed the boat altogether. And this is worth, you know, many times more than he thinks it is. He's missing what makes this essential. Or they have a customer and Nigel says, look, if I, for whatever discount I can negotiate or whatever fee I can, commission I can charge my customer, that's how I earn a living, like any commission-based business. Or thirdly, the dealer, which happens very often, is he or herself a collector of books and is buying it for their own long-term portfolio. But there is a great deal of it takes place. So once you see that, it calls into question the notion of there being a correct, established value for something.
I guess, again, getting back to the words, it's how persuasive you are when you promote the particular volume that you have. I mean, Max Perkins, for example, is way more important than The Stock Boy, in the sense that he influenced the text.
You know, it's the human touch ultimately that you're searching for. And it took me decades to truly understand that, even though I was already sort of trying to sail on, you know, certain waters in how I built it. But it then struck me, you know, one day that, and I really think it did happen in the course of sort of those sort of semi-conscious flashes, where Hemingway inscribed both of those copies, the one to the stock boy that worked for Sylvia and the copy to Max Perkins, neither of which I believe exists. But, you know, I mean, there's no reason to think that he didn't do it, and or I should say survive. And he had a motive for doing it. And in each case, he held that book in his hand or at his desk and he inscribed it. And that was the human touch. But the reasons for inscribing the book to Max Perkins takes on such a central and foundational impulse in Hemingway's life to build his career that he then is builds on the back of the Scribners. Yeah, that's a very profound exchange that's taking place there. And to be able to trap all of that psychological and aesthetic energy in the guise of that book is really very exciting. And if you get that as a collector, you know, it'll blow your skull off your head. If you don't get it, even an educated, literate person, they'll look at you and say, you know, why would this be worth $75,000 and this be worth $750,000? And if you don't get it, you're never going to be able to explain it to somebody in a cogent and persuasive manner.
Right.
So you, who has, you know, a deep attachment to books, looks at some of the impolitely, I would say, elegant salesmanship that we inject into our catalogs, right? And you get it. A lot of people look at it and say, you know, I could buy the vintage paperback. What are you driving crazy with all this nonsense here?
I guess I get it, but I also get the fact that it's a lot of money for this kind of airy-fairy psychic energy. So he signed the book. But you're making the point that when he signed it, he gave it to him because this person is really, really important to him in his life. And you're capturing kind of that moment. Is that it?
Yeah. Even the Bible starts with the book of Genesis, right? I mean, there has to be an origin story in all significant literary and public careers. So to the extent that you can trap in an object those elements of the story, that's what is, you know, profoundly exciting to collectors. And as I said, you know, if you don't have that impulse to collect awkward. It sounds great over a dinner table, and it sounds really good after three or four bourbons and a cigar, but you know, it just doesn't mean that it's going to alter their life. But you know, if you've seen people like our mutual friend Mark Samuels Lasder, whose life has been dominated in a very healthy manner, I would argue too, by proximity to books and pictures, you know, with literary merit. I mean, it's not even first nature or second nature. It's just his nature, and nature is a nature, as we are learning, is a very dangerous foe to try to fight. We're better off to ally ourselves with nature.
The object itself has this kind of psychic energy. What else? And we talked about changing the world, obviously. Anything else that would immediately captivate a collector or an institution?
Well, I mean, they are two different phenomena, which is to say that if you had, you know, just since we spoke about them, going back, if you had those two copies of Hemingway's privately printed first book, The Three Stories and Ten Poems, the copy endearingly inscribed to the young French stock boy at Shakespeare and Company, and then the copy inscribed to Maxwell Perkins when he's in New York City and meeting him in 24 for the first time. And you went to a New York Public Library, a University of Texas, a Yale, you know, Stanford, major American research institutions that have real holdings of Hemingway. They all have copies of Three Stories and Ten Poems. Probably in some instances, they have multiple copies because they bought multiple collections in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and they were there. Or they were given gifts of multiple collections. And you said, look, I found these two extraordinarily interesting copies in a private collection, and they're for sale. No institution would come near those books, you know, at those prices in 100 years, because they have no research value. They have an emotional, to permit you to use that overused word of psychic, a psychic centrifugal force that just compels the person, the collector, to move closer and closer to that object. But the distinction is that there is historically been between an institution and an individual is driven by research. Now, defining what research is, you know, is I suppose, you know, like the Supreme Court justice said, you know, it's like pornography. I don't know what it is, but I know when I see it. Right? So each institution comes and, you know, tries to define what its own mission is. There's been a sea change in the last 10 years, which is afflicted, I think that's the right word, afflicted the book business at the same time, or maybe the impulses were simultaneous. I've believed, and I've said this in other interviews, I've said it once in a film, but I think in many ways the life of the book is, or the book as an organic object has a certain terminal illness built into it. Might not kill it in a generation, might take two or three, but the value that we ascribe to certain types of texts, mostly imaginative, has faded in the face of this superabundance of quasi-factual information that floods across people's screens every day. And in the process of people absorbing that information, it's also shattered, it seems to me, their concentration. So the idea that a 14 to 15 to 16-year-old girl who spends her weeks on Instagram and TikTok and other forms of social media is going to spend the weekend trying to understand the narrative intricacies of Mrs. Dalloway or To the Lighthouse, it's very hard. I mean, the concentration just isn't going to be there, and they'll lose patience very, very quickly. But what's replaced it in the book business, and then also, I believe, you know, to some extent at the institutional level, is this almost clarion call that they're hearing toward the accumulation and trapping of physical evidence of people's place in the world.
Ephemera has been on the rise, obviously.
It's not just merely ephemera, because ephemera is always actually, and I've thought about this, you know, at length over the last number of years, ephemera has always existed within the book business. And if you go back and look at booksellers' catalogs from the 20s, 30s, 40s, you'll see the word oftentimes the title pages of ephemera, right? I mean, the Hogarth Press, for example, generated dozens of catalogs and flyers and notices that you could collect just the ephemera of the Hogarth Press, and if you were successful at it and had some copies that were annotated by Leonard of Virginia or John Layman, that would be very exciting. So that form of ephemeron, you know, has existed. What seems to be taking place, and I think this has to probably derive, again, from just the endless amount of information or data that exists online, is this focus on anything that has survived that somehow documents a moment or a place. You'll see catalogs now, for example, one of the areas that's very heavily collected, seemingly very heavily collected, both by private and institutional buyers in the United States, and I think even more institutional than buyer, are things that relate to both the civil rights movement and not to both, but to the civil rights movement, to the radicalization in the 60s of elements of the movement, and then ultimately, you know, through things like the Black Arts Movement or what have you, right? And it's astonishing to people when they discover the abundance of ephemera, posters, pamphlets, circulars that the Black Panther Party generated. I mean, it's really quite extraordinary. I mean, because prior to people looking retrospectively at the Panther movement, Black Panther movement, it seems somehow to exist on television with machine guns pointed at, you know, police officers or what have you. But the presses were going in every city in the United States, seemingly 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And I look at things that now appear for sale, pamphlets, posters for $300, $500, $5,000, that very frankly, back in the early 80s, when I was one of the very, very few people even handling African-American material and publishing catalogs dedicated to doing exhibitions. I mean, you couldn't give this stuff away for $10, $15, $20. I mean, there was no market for it. So the question that arises is, you know, why is that? And I think the answer is, as we move from a non-text-based culture to a visual culture, to one that is going to, you know, as the old joke is, I mean, you know, once it goes onto the internet, onto Google, it lives forever, right? So, I mean, people spend, I'm sure you see this, you know, just enormous amount of time each day, just sort of going to the rabbit holes that are available on the internet. And once you go into a rabbit hole, there's not a lot of light. So it's pretty hard to sit back and start reading, you know, Pope and Samuel Johnson and Virginia Woolf and you know, Saul Bellow.
Okay, so what are you getting at?
I suppose I was, you know, circuitously going to the idea that there's a distinction that's taking place between what once was central to the book business to what is becoming more marginal. And in some ways, I suppose, you know, it's less compelling to somebody like me because the principles upon which I adhered upon going into the business, which was research and the individual copy of the central text, you know, have melted at the sides, and I think continue to at this point. I mean, I see catalogs now that are issued by some of the brighter booksellers I know that have no books in them any longer. You know, they're reduced to, you know, photo albums of women who served in the WACs of the Second World War.
It's more like a documenting of what took place. Well, and I think that's the thing. They want to capture the zeitgeist of the time or something.
Well, I think it has something to do with a certain type of nostalgia, too, because it isn't as if people are collecting menus from 18th century Parisian restaurants, though if a good one turned up, there would be a market for it. But, you know, I've never met anybody yet, or, you know, or 19th century English, you know, railroad schedules. So it's very interesting to see certain types of things. You, during the pandemic, this burst of energy and money that was dedicated to online auctions dedicated to selling unused video games and sports trade cards. And this morning in the news, there was a piece that the first soccer trade card to ever sell for $1 million traded yesterday. No surprise, it was a Pele card, right? But, you know, I mean, if somebody told you 3-4 years ago that there'd be a Pele card that would trade for $1 million, you would have, after the person told you that, quietly called the psychiatric ward and suggest they pick the person up and, you know, and give them some help. So, I mean, those are profound changes. I mean, you know, I mean, when you ask some older booksellers if they have an impression of people spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on unused video games, you know, they just shake their head in disbelief.
Would you say that your job then these days is to try and get a handle on, again, it's looking for value. It seems to me that, you know, with and going back to Sting just because he's there, you know, his archive, that's something that you can easily sort of grasp onto and package up or make a really good argument for and sell it to some organization that's what you're focusing on, that kind of work, because it's more in line with historically what you've done? Or are you trying to get a whole sense of where all this is going so that you can capitalize on it somehow?
I think I understand the question you're asking. You know, I'm still rooted in the same soil that I've been tilling since I went into business in the late 70s. I'm more than willing to look at archives that are now, I suppose you'd have to characterize them as unorthodox relative to the ones that in the past I handled. If you look at a list of the projects I've worked on over the years and looked at the projects from the 80s and 90s that we were successful in crafting and then selling, yeah, they do read like something that flirts with Western canon. If you look at the archives that we're handling right now,
who, for example, Glenn? Like what are you looking at right now? What have you got right now?
Well, we did a deal recently, sold the papers of the very glamorous and beloved female writer Eve Babbitts, who really was along with Joan Didion, sort of the female voice of California in the 60s and 70s. Again, 7 years ago, before the New York Review of Books started to reprint all of Eve's work, a name that was little known. We recently did a deal for the vast audio archive of the feminist podcasters, The Kitchen Sisters, with the Library of Congress. These are projects that you know, even as recently as 10 years ago, I probably wouldn't have given much thought to. But you know, because of the length of time we've been doing this, and the fact that the word archive seems to have been introduced into the language in a manner that 20 years ago, it wasn't. If you look at a directory of booksellers in any community, it's very often the way they list them is, the names of the businesses, their address, their contact information, and then they will describe what they deal in, you know, travels and voyages or, you know, mathematics. Half of them today all deal in archives. 10 years ago, yes, the word archive, yes, simply wasn't part of the general dialogue of the bookselling community. You know, at moments I feel, you know, bemused, and other moments I feel slightly frustrated, feeling that somehow, you know, I mean, you know, something that I was significantly responsible for helping mature,
yes,
that was now,
yes,
been appropriated by the whole world.
It's like everyone's out there trying to figure out, okay, so who's got anything that I can sell, anything of value that I can sell, and I'm going to go after him and pitch him on selling the archive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's even, you know, that's articulate and insightful, but it's gotten to the point that, and I suppose this is just a function of what modest success we've enjoyed that's been, fortunately for us, publicized through various elements of the press, and also the size of the transactions as they're documented in the press. But I would think that right now, probably half, if not more, of the archives that we work on come to us. I mean, we're not even out there, you know, kicking on doors and rattling the window panes to get people's attention. It's a blessing, but there's a lot of time that we spend gently letting people know that, you know, the amount of energy that is required to put these transactions together, you know, wouldn't justify, the result wouldn't justify the expenditure on other parties' part. But everybody suddenly, which I think quite interestingly, and I do think it goes back to the experience of daily life online. I mean, you know, everybody has a email archive. I mean, but it just seems to me that suddenly, you know, the whole world, you know, everybody has an archive in a way that 25 years ago, when I would give a talk, you know, people would say, I remember once lecturing at the University of Texas, probably, you know, 25 years ago, roughly.
And yeah.
I was talking at a conference, and the issue that I was asked to address was my relationship with the University of Texas in terms of the transfer of archives from generators of beneficiaries to Austin and to the Ransom Center. And at the end, you know, after talking what I thought was, remarkably succinctly and cogently for an hour on the issue archives, they opened up the floor for questions, and elegant older woman at the front raised her hand and stood up and said, "I just have one question." She says, "What is this thing you keep talking about, an archive?" it was very poignant, and yet it was something of a mystery at that stage.
I have a question now about the way you work, and that is, you're not a joiner, you're not a member of any of the professional associations, and you know, you talked about the horse trading and stuff that goes on. And
I'm genuinely very close to a dozen, 15 booksellers. Some older than myself, though as I age, there won't be many of those left, and you know, many who I came of age with, and I've taken a great interest in a number of younger booksellers with whom I've developed both professional and personal friendships, and try to act as something of a, you know, a Virgil through the vicissitudes of
through hell.
But you know, I think that I went into business. Fortunately, it's something I would advocate to anybody in any profession. You know, when I was 24, literally a month after my 24th birthday, and I was so naive and stupid that I had very little anxiety about how the business would evolve. Because if you fail from, you know, a subterranean level, you don't have very far to fall. So I mean, then it seems to me that there was a lot of risk involved in this, right? And fortunately, for you know, reasons that too multiple to take care of time up, I was lucky, truly lucky, in that a number of people took an interest and therefore a shine to me at an early age and promoted me in ways that you know, I had not anticipated, and that went a long way to strengthening my early position. I think there was a tremendous, that's an exaggeration. There was a legitimate backlash that I also experienced at a young age from a generation of booksellers who were, you know, one or two decades further down in the path, or even three decades. There were, you know, low grade urban myths that grew up that I had come from a very wealthy background, and therefore I was dealing in books that were, you know, above my punching weight at that age, because you know, how could you be if you didn't have family money? And I think it soured me to some extent on what I saw as a not a perverse camaraderie, but you know, it had a brackishness about it, a sort of a flintiness that just didn't appeal to me. And very frankly, without embarrassing my family, I was 24 years old. I was living in New York City, having been raised in a very rustic environment in upstate New York. At the time, if the choice was hanging out with these booksellers at the Grolier Club or chasing young dancers, female dancers downtown, and there wasn't any choice, I was going to spend my time. So it wasn't really that appealing. And by the time I gave some thought to it,
wait a minute, there's no dancing girls at the Grolier Club?
That's right. No. And it may have been also, you know, to some extent, my imperfection. It may have been when I left my adolescence in upstate New York, in what was truly a very rustic and undereducated environment, and went off to southern Vermont to Bennington for college. It opened up a world that I had not been privileged to have access to before. And I think I always had something of a little bit of a chip on my shoulder. I think I probably, having started as early as I did without having any true mentors, probably carried that chip a little bit with me too. But I've never, as far as I can tell, you know, unless my memory is failing me, I've never joined any of the clubs in New York City that, you know, have offered membership, and certainly none of the bookselling organizations. There was also a mechanical reason that I wasn't that interested in the book organizations, professional organizations that exist, which is to a large degree, they exist to mount and promote international book fairs. To some extent, I guess they exist to help settle minor domestic disputes amongst booksellers, but fundamentally they're there to promote the book as a commercial object in the guise of public exhibitions, long before the art world gathered that art fairs were, you know, a way of increasing their profile. And it always struck me, I recollect going to a number of major book fairs in New York City and taking people with me who were buying books from me, so we could walk around, I could show them things, we could buy some things. And a slightly idiosyncratic client of mine who at the time was the president of the largest Teamsters local in New York City, his name was Dennis Silverman, went to the book fair with me. And we were building what became not only a notable, but to use your other word, notorious, James Joyce collection, which after Dennis was arrested and indicted and sent away, we reacquired and put it to the market. And the New York Times wrote a long article about the Teamsters of James. That is it. Yes.
That is such a freaking amazing catalog.
It was a great collection.
You've got 7 copies of Ulysses up front.
Yeah, that double page spread is a beautiful one.
I'm so happy I've got this.
Nonetheless, I recollect walking through this book fair with Mr. Silverman,
yeah,
who was an enthusiast but not a educated man. We were walking around and he came to me. We parted company. He walked in one aisle, another. We met a half hour later. He said, "I've got to ask you a question." I said, "What's that?" He said, "This is a rare book fair." I said, "Yes." He said, "If it's a rare book fair, why are all the same books here?" And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "I've seen more copies of Ulysses, you know, on this floor in the last half hour than I thought existed in the world. And they're all here." And it always struck me that you know, somehow if you, without context and without education, without background, suspend people's disbelief in that fashion, that's a very difficult amount of trust to rebuild if the perception on the part of the necessary party to the transaction, the consumer, the collector, perceives this material as being ubiquitous and common. And I think that contributed a little bit to my sense that I would be better off just to keep to myself and keep my inventory quiet. It's one reason I didn't go online until a very, very late moment in my life, and not even because of me, but because of my daughters and my younger staff who said, "We're making a mistake that we should do this." Because I always felt that in dealing almost exclusively in unique material, whether it be for the private market or the research market, you know, I knew something that was privileged and that was proprietary.
Yeah.
But by just throwing it out in the world, you know, willy-nilly to anybody who could turn on a MacBook, that wasn't a particularly intelligent way of putting that information to use.
Can we just revisit that experience you just described about the book fair? Were you basically saying that a lot of these booksellers were saying that this book was very, very rare? What was it that turned him off or you off?
It wasn't a matter of saying that it's rare, but you know, if you walked into the Armory in New York City for a rare book fair, if you walked into, you know, wherever in Los Angeles in a given year a rare book fair is being held, if you show up at a hotel in London for a yearly international book fair, the implication is that you are going to look at things that are difficult to procure and are worth your time and attention. So in the case of my friend, Mr. Silverman, all he could see was that every copy of Ulysses that he was looking at, depending on its condition in those days now, you know, were ranging in value from $10,000 to $35,000 to $40,000. But the fact that there were just so many copies, you know, at that moment, you know, the snapshot of that evening, that opening evening of the book fair, and each bookseller purportedly trying to present their copy of Ulysses as something that was different than the copy 4 booths or 6 booths or 8 booths away, that just struck me as you know, a slightly complex formula to try to explain what makes books both interesting and potentially valuable at the same time. Because if, you know, if it's a matter of just picking and choosing from, you know, any one of 8 copies that are there, that's hard to define as a uncommon, scarce, or even rare book. And that's something that stuck with me for a long time. I think it also probably contributed to driving me into a narrower frame of saying, you know, I'm going to look for unique material. We built a collection back in the 90s for a real estate developer in New York City, now deceased, named Roger Reckler. And for various reasons that were unique to Mr. Reckler's situation, in 2002, he decided that he wanted to cash out of the books he had bought. He had bought, you know, very serious books. Every book in his collection was a unique copy of that title. Or maybe I should say 92% of them, but the overwhelming majority. And that was the principle upon which I prevailed upon him to build this collection with me. And Christie sold it in October 2002. And there hadn't been, probably since the 70s, when the world was a radically different place and the auction houses were radically different, a collection of 20th century literature, 19th and 20th century literature, that even looked fractionally as good as this and was sold as a single owner sale. There was a sale, three-part sale at Sotheby's, when it was still Sotheby's Park Burnett on Madison Avenue, of a man named an insurance executive from Connecticut named Jonathan Goodwin. And Goodwin and copies, you know, carry a great deal of distinction in the state. So Mr. Reckler and I finally agreed upon a deal with Christie's that I put together for him. And Christie's was kind enough to write their catalog by using the catalog we had written for Mr. Reckler. And if I said that the pre-sale estimates were $2.5 to $3.5 million, it made upwards of $7 million by the end of the afternoon. There were only a couple hundred books in it. And with that, in 2002, there was a very demonstrable sea change that took place in the market. And suddenly people went from focusing a great deal of energy on beautiful copies of 20th century books in dust jackets. They didn't kick them, you know, out of the party, but suddenly everybody wanted association copies. They wanted the Oscar Wildes and the Conrads and the Joyces and the Virginia Woolfs and the Hemingways inscribed to other literary figures. And I'm not by any stretch of the imagination suggesting, though maybe it sounds like it's implicit what I'm saying, that I was responsible for that. But by concentrating all of this material in one sale and people yes. having an opportunity to see what happens, what resonates when this is all, you know, juxtaposed. I mean, yeah. really caused people to stand up and take notice.
That's exactly what happened with your African American catalog, as I understand it.
Much slower. That project which I have a profound affection for, and a catalog that
I got that catalog. I'm so happy I have it.
No, it's what it's. I think without question, one of the two or three best. That we have were able to bring.
And why is that, Glenn? Why is it the best?
Well, it was. Well, first, it's a very beautiful object, as you know, cloth bound, put together by Mr. Kelly in you know, really fine garments. It had a deep novelty to it, which is to say, nobody had attempted to narrate the key strains of the African American experience in the United States from 1619 to the moment we issued that catalog in the 90s, through the objects that were in the books and manuscripts that were in that catalog. And there was a coherence to it. I mean, you could read it and walk away and say, gee, I understand something. At least I would hope you could.
Yeah, exactly. You learned a lot.
And it was beautifully written and edited. And it had a great deal that went for it. And it was at a very good moment, too, because... I built the collection because from the get-go, which is right at the business, I was always dealing in African-American material. It interested me greatly. Minority voices, maybe because I was raised Jewish and sensitive to being Jewish, but minority voices interested me greatly, and Black literature interested me. Back in the early 80s, if you look at a bookseller's catalog, the way that they would catalog and offer African-American literature was not under the name of James Baldwin or Toni Morrison or James Weldon Johnson or Frederick Douglass, but after you got done with the Kings and the Amoses and the W.H. Auden, you get to the B's, and parenthetically you would say Black literature, Black literature, Black literature, and that all the Black material would end up in the B's, you know, under Black literature. Wow. So I had begun to accumulate a not insignificant inventory of Black literature, and I couldn't sell it. Nobody wanted it. I mean, nobody wanted it. And so I thought, screw it. You know, if nobody wants it, I'm just going to build this collection. And right. I spent, you know, probably a dozen years collecting African-American literature, African-American documents, ancillary material, with an eye that one day I was going to do something with it, though I had no idea at the time what I was going to do. And then the thought of putting the catalog together came. The catalog was was almost through press at the time that the O.J. Simpson trial was coming to a head. So questions relating to racial tensions and the history of race in the United States were very much in front and center. And when we got ready to publish the catalog, we also determined we were going to do an exhibition in what was then our rare book gallery on 76th and Madison in New York. When I thought about it, I said, yeah, this is, you know, potentially problematic because the two names on the title page, myself and my co-author, were Horowitz and Weinstein. And so here, you know, with two Jewish guys once again exploiting the Black experience. Yeah. So yeah. I thought, I need to get a little bit of sunscreen here. So I initially reached out to the publisher of the legendary Black newspaper in Harlem, the Amsterdam News, who was kind enough to get the great jazz critic and cultural critic Stanley Crouch to write a piece about it. Poignantly, after Stanley died, we handled his archive and sold that to the Schoenberg in New York City. But I still knew that I wanted something more than that. And so I sought out a woman who had a Black woman named Terry Williams, who had her own PR firm here in the city that was dedicated to all things African-American. She had cut her teeth as one of Oprah Winfrey's earliest PR flacks. And I went to her at the suggestion of a mutual friend and explained to her what I was trying to do. And Terry looked at me, Terry eventually became a very dear friend, but looked at me like I was out of my mind. She said, what are you talking about? And I said, look, I understand. I said, I'm this Jewish kid, comes from the Castle Mountains. I've published this catalog. I'm going to put it out. And I'm telling you, I know how this world works, and I'm going to get a lot of blowback. Yeah, I'm going to get a lot of blowback. And therefore, I'm looking for some sort of body armor here. So she said, I get what you're getting at. She said, let me think about this for a little while. And I'll get back to you in a couple of days. So she called and she said, look, she said, if it doesn't make sense, you just tell me, but I think I have an opportunity that might serve the purpose that you came to me seeking a solution for. And I said, what's that? She said, at the opening of the exhibition, she said, what would you think about a co-host for the opening? I said, sure, who's that? She said, Johnny Cochran. I said, Johnny Cochran. I said, that would be just fabulous. I mean, most famous lawyer in America at that moment, right? Yes. And Johnny was opening a New York office after the dramatic attention that he received for the OJ trial. And Terry was doing his PR work in the city. And so Johnny shared the invitation with me, and we opened up the collection together and had a dinner that evening. And for the next, alas, he died prematurely, the next 4 or 5 years, he was the biggest buyer of African-American material I had. So it went full circle. It took years.
You didn't say who you got to write in the catalog.
It was a dear friend of mine who started life as a client, the amateur historian, a good one too, named Randy Weinstein.
Right.
The title page. We also did get a preface. So I did leave this out. And I did get my longtime friend, Henry Louis Gates, write the introduction to the catalog.
Yes.
In exchange for the first edition of Phyllis Wheatley's poems that we had in the catalog at the time for $7,500. That today, that copy would probably be worth about $50,000. But if the material of that catalog was back in my hands today, goodness gracious, I mean, it would just be explosive compared to what it was then. So we were handling the right material in the right environment at the wrong time is the only way to describe it. But it was a great catalog. You're right about that.
Well, that tells me quite a bit about what you do, Glenn. Do you think we've covered off what you do adequately?
I could go on for another 7 or 8 hours if you want, but you've seen that impulse of my part in the past, so I shall restrain it. No, I think that there's enough there for people to reflect on, and if at a later date it generates enough conversation and we want to go back and approach it from different perspectives, I'd be more than happy to do that also.
Okay. Just before we finish, there's a couple, I'm a little bit slow this afternoon because there's two points that I still haven't quite grasped. One, you said that your catalog was used by Christie's. What exactly? Because it seems to me that is sort of a sign of success of your catalog in a way.
No.
What does that mean?
In this case, it was both financial and tactical. Auction houses, this is no secret. I mean, they would broadcast this all day, and probably give me a free lunch for giving it to you for the podcast. Auction houses depend to some degree on third parties bringing material to them for sale. Yeah, they know where bodies are buried. The auction houses at any given moment might not. And the auction houses, like any commercial enterprise, And you know, as much as you praise my catalogs, I will never lose sight of the fact that they are commercial vehicles. So you do have to call into question some of what we say in there. But that being the case, if you go,
hyperbole, but it is salesmanship.
You know, if you wake up one day to find out an ancient aunt of yours passed on, and little did you know that she collected Whistler etchings and had a very good collection of it, and you said, "Look, I'm going to take these, you know, to Sotheby's or Christie's and let them sell them," they will offer you what in the trade is called an IC, an introductory commission. And the commission will be a percentage of what they can gain for themselves by the sale of the material. So you are complicit at that moment in the transaction with the auction house, because what you will take away as your introductory commission is a function of what they get for the material. So when I was trying to figure out what would be the appropriate venue for Mr. Reckler to sell his books in, I was in many ways the interlocutor between Mr. Reckler and the auction houses. And the auction houses, you know, very forthrightly said, you know, I mean, we'll pay you an introductory commission for this collection, because we are desperate to get this collection. Desperate.
You did up a catalog for it?
One of the terms upon which we built his collection was that everything would be cataloged within an inch of its life. And every year we would do up at Christmas from a gift, and we would bind up the current status of the collection. So the first year there were 32 pages, the second year there were 64 pages, then 128, but we would give it to him, you know, as a Christmas gift every year in a beautiful Morocco binding.
Okay.
We catalog everything that we sell for the people we sell it to, but this was keeping a real catalog book by book by book, which was one of the terms upon which he agreed that he would go out and work on this project. He wanted something he could share with his family and something he could read and continue to understand the dimensions of what he was doing. So when it came time to strike a deal with Christie's, which we were able to after much back and forth, I realized that if, since everybody knew that I had built this collection for Roger, everybody in the trade knew it, of course, and he was buying books from nobody but me for this collection, that if I was seen as somehow being in bed with Christie's over the outcome of the sale, it would, I think, appropriately call into question, particularly amongst skeptical intelligences, what my relationship to this whole activity was. So if, for example, the catalog comes out and there's an inscribed copy of Ulysses with an estimate of $80,000 to $120,000, and I say, "Nigel, that's a fantastic book that you really should have in your collection. I think you should spend $350,000 on the book." A perfectly reasonable question would be, "Glenn, wait a minute. I mean, you built this collection. You know, you took it to Christie's. It's common knowledge. Christie's says it's worth $80,000 to $120,000. Therefore, under New York state law, the highest the reserve could be is $80,000. You're telling me to spend 450 times, you know, 450% more than the low estimate on this book, and you're going to be participating, you know, in the outcome of the transaction, right? So it's your benefit, Glenn, to convince me to spend more and more and more and more, right?" So what I did in the case of Christie's, and Christie's agreed to this, was rather than be seen as a partner of Christie's, I agreed that I would take my fee by selling them this extensive catalog that we had written of Mr. Reckler's collection, with the idea that would be my commission for bringing them the deal. The catalog would save them a great deal of work and labor.
So they actually paid for the work that you
put. They paid for the catalog. And the deal was that they could do one of three things. They could publish it verbatim. They could redact it to serve the purposes. Or they could use it simply for background.
I understand.
So okay. We struck the deal. They paid me 50%. They paid me the second 50% of the fee the day before the sale. It permitted me to go to anybody that was the interested, both institutionally and privately, bidding at the sale, and say with a clear conscience, I have, you know, any advice I'm giving you is agnostic.
You're out.
If they don't sell a single book, I get my commission. If they sell them for $1 billion, I don't get a nickel more than that. I was the biggest buyer at the sale. I think I spent of the $7 million, probably about $3.5 million, all on commission for various people. And you know, that was also important to Christie's too, because they knew that nobody knew the collection as well as I did, and therefore could go out and represent it piece by piece to potential buyers better than I could at the same time. So
very good. Okay. And just finally, we'll end up with, I still don't understand this seven sissies on the floor of that fair. Are you saying it's kind of like they were car dealers and they all had, like, they all grouped together?
Let me finish.
This is, so you go there because they're all there showing off their, what they've got in comparison. So the buyer can kind of kick the tires and go around and look at them all in a very easy way before they buy, and you don't like that? Is that what you're saying?
Well, look, I mean, I'm sure it's the same in Canada as in the United States. I mean, in all small to middle to large cities, it's very common to find the car dealerships, you know, on the same strip.
It makes it convenient.
It makes it very, very convenient. But one dealer is selling Mercedes and another is selling Toyotas and a third is selling Chevrolets and a fourth is selling Hondas. All eight of these people were selling Ulysses. they were selling the same product.
It's condition, of course.
But that would then mean that...
And association.
That the Nigel Beale that wandered in to the armory to see if rare books might be something that would capture his imagination would walk out getting even more confused than when he was preparing to enter with questions bouncing around in his mind about, is this something that would appeal to me? Because you would look and you would say, this is a rare book, and it just seems to me that everywhere I go, I'm seeing the same objects.
So it's not rare. You go in and you think it's rare. It's supposed to be rare.
Rare is a word that you have, I'm sure, been schooled by other booksellers you've interviewed, is a overused and simplified word. I mean, there used to be definitions of what a rare book was. It was the idea of procuring something that is truly uncommon is a motivating factor in anybody who is building a collection. You know, goes back to that image I used before of the human touch, right? I mean, at one extreme, at one terminus. So, for those who are in the process of being educated, walking into an environment like that could be and was for many people a confounding experience. I mean, just confounding.
Because what?
Because how do you, without having any context, any background, and any education and connoisseurship, how do you distinguish why one book is $10,000, one is $20,000, one is $30,000, one is $15,000, one is $18,000? I mean, and they all look to your untrained eye as being the same object.
I see. So it is confusing without the context, without the catalog, basically.
Well, it's large, and I would say that anybody who builds a genuinely meaningful collection in many different fields, whether it be porcelain or furniture, or books or pictures, and books, will ultimately find a dealer or a small number of dealers who earn their confidence and who they will turn to for advice and insight into explaining what are the idiosyncrasies of the marketplace. I mean, it's, you know, like any secondhand goods, and you know, these may be more refined than 1950s chests of drawers in a used furniture store, but they are secondhand goods, and the secondhand market is for better or worse, and there are many people who are critical of it. It can be a very non-transparent environment. So to have somebody who can function as something of a searchlight, a flashlight for you as a collector is a valuable relationship as time goes on.
Well, Glenn, speaking of value, you know how to spot value and present value. And so do I when it comes to picking guests on the podcast.
That's astonishing. You've had me on more than once.
Thank you for your valuable contribution, Glenn. It's always a pleasure.
But the same here, Nigel, and I look forward to chatting with you again.
Very good.
Enjoy the weekend.
All right.